Right. Yeah, you're not the hippie nanny state that we are.
Nope.
Banky, you guys wish you were the hippie nanny state.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to say. I think Victoria takes that that crown.
Hell yeah, brother.
Welcome to GCP Bytes episode number 21 for Friday, the 18th of July, 2025. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech, and I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, how are we going to power all this stuff? VMware, VMware, VMware. What happened with Qantas? And context rot, what exactly is it? Find out in the AI wars. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
I think I've got the plague.
I feel the same, mate. I feel the same. And freshly back from gallivanting around the country, it's our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, Ian?
I'm fantastic. I don't know what's wrong with you, bros.
You're fresh air. You're
fresh
breathing
air,
with your lungs.
Artesian spa water.
Yeah, did you get into any of the artesian spas?
Yeah,
how good are they?
Yeah. Out at Baduri, their aquatic centre, they've got a...
Oh, you did get into that one? Yeah.
Yeah, so they've got a pool there. Their main pool is heated. So in the middle of winter, you can use it. Apparently it's 26 degrees.
Yeah.
And then they've got the water that comes straight out of the bore they cool off a little bit first, and it's at 40 degrees.
Whoa.
And I can tell you 40 degrees is hard to get into.
It's hot, yeah.
26 degrees is even harder.
Yeah.
You think 26 degrees, that's nice and warm. No, not after you get out of 40.
No, yeah. Yeah, we used to have a spa at my old place. I'm going to tell you, the difference between 38 and 40 was significant. Yeah.
Yeah, I reckon it probably took me a good 5 minutes to actually get in there because I'd put my feet in, and then I'd last maybe 30 seconds on the first round and have to pull my feet back out because it's so hot. And then back in again, and just kept doing that until I got accustomed to it and just kept getting deeper and deeper into it until I was actually sitting in it.
So you look like a lobster.
No, apparently I didn't. Apparently I looked fine. I don't know. I couldn't see myself.
And what else did you get up to while you were swanning about?
Mate, we did, it was a massive road trip. So it was about 4,400 kilometres all up. I am very impressed with the new car towing a 3-ton caravan at about 22.5 litres per 100, which was a little bit worse than I had estimated, but I didn't really know the numbers. I was sort of basing it off what the interwebs was telling me. But having said that, I just put the thing on cruise control and just let it tow the caravan at whatever revs it needed to.
Yeah, so many factors go into that consumption, though.
Yeah, that's right. I can't get over how green the outback is. Mm. So when you think of the outback of Australia, you think of red dirt or red sand, massive fields where there's barely trees, let alone any grass, and it's flat. It is so green out there at the moment. It is not funny. It's phenomenal. We did a tour up to Big Red, the sand dune at the edge in the Simpson Desert National Park, for a sunset tour. And there is still water, for as far as the eye can see, in between Big Red and the next sand dune.
Yeah, right.
And they reckon it's probably about half a metre deep.
Is that road closed at the moment, or
no? You can still drive through it.
Still drive through. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. The wildlife out there. So normally you see lots and lots of wildlife really close to the road because that's where the greenery is. You know, those little verges on the side, the little ditches, that's usually green.
Full of water, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Any rain or any dew or anything like that, it just rolls off into there and keeps that nice and green. So all the wildlife comes up close to the road. We saw virtually none of that.
Because there's a lot more places for it to be.
Channel country is just green everywhere now.
Mm.
We did see lots of animals that have been hit by cars and that sort of stuff, but I'm assuming that's just the normal sort of dusk hour of death that happens on all highways.
Yep, yep. But that 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon spot.
Yes, yeah. We were very much trying to be in camp by sort of 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I did notice that I hadn't expected is that the sun doesn't get up in the outback until about 7 o'clock in the morning.
Right. Okay.
So you think about how flat the country is. So, okay, out here on the East Coast, it's hilly and all that sort of stuff.
You're a little further west, right? Yeah.
Yeah, you are a little bit further west, but also you're sitting behind the Great Dividing Range. You can't see that, but it's massive. So it delays the sunrise a little bit. And the area out there and the Drummond Ranges and all the other ranges that are inland of it, but it's also flat for as far as the eye can see. There's barely a hill in the country.
That's right.
Out there. And so you're down reasonably low. You're sitting behind all these ranges that are to the east of you. And so everything gets up just that little bit later.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, it's a different experience out there. I have to say, I love it out there.
It is. It is. The cold hits differently out there too.
Oh, it's cold. Yeah.
Birds you don't in the middle of winter at -3.
Yeah, you don't expect it in the desert, but boy, it gets cold.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it gets very chilly.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was a fantastic trip. The little caravan that we towed worked beautifully.
I wouldn't call it little.
Okay, it's an 18.5-foot caravan. It towed very nicely. I barely knew it was there for most of the trip. And it was comfy. So, you know.
That's good, yeah. And no technical mishaps or failures or things like that. All went pretty smoothly by the sound of it.
Only technical mishap we had, there was two. So on the first day, we were driving a billowheeler. And the fridge kept saying that it couldn't get battery power.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, that's a bit odd. When we got into Billowheeler, I had a look at the plug and everything because it goes through the two of the big pins on the 12-pin plug. Mm. And there was some green rot in there. So
right. It's getting like, a voltage drop. Yep.
So we're getting a bit of voltage drop there. So I ended up going into Repco or Supercheap or something like that. I got a little little cylindrical wire brush that fit into the drill and just cleaned it out and then sprayed it with a heap of contact cleaner and off we went again and didn't have a problem since.
That was good.
Yep. And the only other issue was we'd bought new brass fittings for the water hose and they had stops in them. And the stoppers weren't pushed all the way in, so it wasn't letting any water through, and I couldn't work out why we weren't getting water in the caravan. But that only started happening, like, I don't know, 4 days in.
Mm.
I ended up figuring it out. It took me 2 days, though.
Bit foiled slow on the uptake.
Yep. Yeah, literally, filled by the connectors. So yeah. I just took them out, and yeah.
Nice. Well, mate, it sounds like a great trip, and I'm stinging to get back out there personally, but that won't be happening just yet. In the meantime, while you're away, I did switch over my Firewall to PF Sense.
Ooh, how have you found the adjustment?
It was actually pretty painless. Yeah, I was just trying to get used to the way the firewall, creating firewall rules in there. Just the GUI is a bit different to the way it works in Untangle. But yeah, no, pretty much no problems. I'm still undecided exactly how I want to do my DHCP and DNS for the moment. I've got DNS and DHCP on Pi-hole, but that does mean I'll have to set up helper addresses for the other networks. I've got a couple of networks with VMware stuff on it here, which I haven't sort of completely finished off the configuration for that. Whereas before everything was just on Untangle, and it was the DHCP and DNS and all the networks
responded to all the
networks. So it does, but if I want to use Pi-hole,
If you want to have dynamic DNS with DHCP, like auto registration, the DNS and the DHCP need to be on the same server, right?
Yep.
Which means I've got to have Pi-hole and the network to itself with helper addresses and stuff. So you haven't quite fully 100% committed to one way or the other at the moment. I'm just sort of testing which will go. But the way I've got it now seems to be reliable, so that may be the way I end up going with it. Yeah, so I don't know.
Yeah, cool.
No problems at the moment.
I haven't used PFS for years.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, it was pretty easy to set up, and my topology is a little bit different this time too. See, what I'd done before was I had a trunk coming into Proxmox, and then on the actual VM in Untangle, I'd had discrete interfaces.
Mm-hmm.
But what that meant was if I wanted to add a new network to Untangle, I had to reboot Untangle because I had to add the interface to the VM and then reboot Untangle.
Mm.
But what I've done this time is I've brought the trunk all the way up to the VM, and then the VLAN tagging is done on the interface in PFSense.
Yeah, nice.
Sub-interface.
Sub-interface. So if I want to add an interface, easy. I just add the tag on the switch. I'll just allow it on the switch and then add the sub-interface and PFSense, and bang, there it is. I don't need to do any reboot or muck around like that. So that was an intentional topology change because I knew I was anticipating that problem, and that seems to just work really easily and really well. And I put my external VLANs 100, I put that on there, and I wouldn't come up with an address to start with, and I realized, oh, hang on, that's because Untangle's got it. Well, I can't have both running. I'm just going to have to shut down Untangle. And the kids complained. And it was about 30 seconds later, I started up PFSense. And bang, it just worked. I went, hang on, I've got internet straight away. This never happens. Like I was anticipating a problem. But no, it just worked straight away. Okay, fine. Nice. We'll just go with it then, right? So, relatively painless. So there's that, and then next Friday I'm sitting another exam, the DevOps exam, which I have done exactly zero preparation for. So this weekend I'll get some time and I'll sit down, I'll cram for that a little bit. Hopefully they haven't revved it too much.
This seems to be a trend, Banky. Every time you go for an exam, you've done no prep until the day before you start cramming and then go, I've sat it and I passed.
I smashed it.
What's next after DevOps for you? What's the next one that's expiring?
Developer Pro.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and that's it. That's this round of certifications. Yeah,
I reckon
done.
That's like the easiest one.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, it does have some idiosyncrasies to it, though. The developer one.
Mm. I reckon ACE was harder than the developer one.
Yeah, I never sat the ace. I just went straight for the pro. So that's kind of what I'm doing. Now, Dave, you had a couple of things. Are you mucking around with printers, you were saying?
I've got to so I've just bought a different brand printer for the farm because I'm sussing out as I move into a factory space later in the year what I'm going to do for my print farm. Am I going to do a pretty expensive set of upgrades across the fleet that I have to a new model, or is it maybe worthwhile like going and benchmarking a couple other different brands and seeing do I standardize? So pretty much all my fleet at the moment is all Prusa machines, so they're made in the Czech Republic. But I've decided to buy a Bamboo Lab X1 Carbon.
Nice.
So that's turned up. And the main driver has been was like they pre-come in enclosures, which is certainly helpful for some of the larger stuff that I print. But admittedly, it's like it's cost as well, right? Like when I was benchmarking the two, I'm like, okay, well, if I go the way I have been going, I have to get them from Europe. I have to pay a load in postage. And then I have to pay import duties when they get here versus the Bamboo Labs are in Sydney. They're made in China, but like they ship from Sydney. Yeah. I ordered it on Thursday and I had it on Monday. might have been Tuesday morning. It's like, it was really quick, and then came pre-assembled. I didn't have to kind of do much with it. Like, so far so good. I haven't done too many test prints and stuff on it yet. That'll be a project for probably next week. But we'll see. It's much more of an experience of like my, paper printer on the desk is, right? Like, it looks like my brother printer.
Yeah. But they need a little bit of calibration too when you first get them, don't they?
Well, yeah, but it was like 20 minutes of doing it itself. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to like tension any belts or anything.
Yeah, right.
Okay. It was pretty much what you'd expect any other kind of appliance. You know, you take it out of the box, you peel off all the plastic and the polystyrene out of it and kind of let it go. So far the new out of box experience has been pretty good.
Literal plug and play. Hey, speaking of awesome, like postage times, one of the things that happened to me when we were on the trip is I had some of those clip-on mirrors, towing mirrors.
Oh, yeah.
They suck. When you're driving down Queensland highways, which are notoriously bad, they just shake. And so you don't see anything that's behind you. You see that there's something there, but you don't know what it is. So I ended up, we got into Lara Wetlands, which is south of Buckalden, and I phoned MSA to get them to ship me a set of mirrors to a bloke in Longreach. It took them 2 days. From the Gold Coast all the way out to Longreach.
Yeah.
Via Star Trek. So it went from Gold Coast that afternoon to Rockhampton. And then the next day it was in Longreach, 900 kilometers west.
That's pretty good.
And I was like, wow, that is good.
And you picked them up when you arrived?
No, I had the bloke I shipped them to fitted it for me for $100. I was like, here you go. $100.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, cool. And what's this Infinity train? What's this all about?
Well, hey, think about how much fuel Ian used.
Yeah.
this was just a cool article that I saw early last week. Fortescue have just deployed this thing called their Infinity train. Right, which is supposed to be, do you ever see Snowpiercer? There's a movie and there's a TV show and it's about like a perpetual motion machine effectively. It's not quite that. The clever thing with their Infinity train is that it is an electric engine, right? Instead of a diesel locomotive, and this is going to be used for hauling significant quantities of iron ore. From mines down to where it all needs to be moved away and processed. And the really cool thing is because they're effectively taking apart a mountain, right? All of this ore is it's sitting up on top of a mountain. They're ripping it apart. They can load it onto the train, and then it's basically regen braking.
So this train will, instead of carrying diesel, it carries batteries, right? And then on the way down the hill, it uses regen braking to charge the batteries?
Yeah, correct. So it gets at the top of the hill, it gets loaded up with ore, and then at that point, the batteries are close to empty. Then as it starts going down the hill, it regen brakes and charges the batteries up the whole way. It gets to the bottom of the hill, the ore is then unloaded, and off it can schlep back up the hill. It can take all the...
With a fully charged battery.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very clever. And Fortescue, that's Twiggy, right?
That is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is the thing. He's pushing for these kind of initiatives, and he's got a whole green energy program as well. We like Twiggy, and we like what Twiggy's doing. He's one of the good guys when it comes to mining.
Yep.
Yeah. In terms of like tearing up the country, he's one of the good ones.
cool idea. Let's see some more of it. Yeah, I like it.
Mm.
All right. Well, with that having been said, let's get on with the show and let's get on with the community news. All right, Ian. I tried to do the community news justice last week. I hope I did it okay. over to you, mate. Let's see how the pros do it.
You did it fine, mate. Look, only a couple of items this week. I'm not going to cover the local GDG chapters this week because the big one that's coming up is Cloud Summit, which is on the 30th of July. So that's in Sydney. You've got to register for it. It is a fantastic day's event. Runs from 8 a.m. until about 5-ish. And you can get to see a whole heap of different talks and tracks about security and workspace and AI and all sorts of really cool stuff. So there is a whole agenda here on it. There's some really big names on it. So jump on and have a look and get yourself registered and get yourself down to Sydney. And then the last one is the APAC Cloud Technical Series on AI Agents. Which very controversially looks like a COVID spore on the front page of it. But anyway, it's an online event. It is happening on the 7th of August, and it's from 1:15 until 5:20. So jump onto that one as well.
Cool. Links in the show notes. Go and check those out. And I assume that Sydney one will be in the Sydney Google office.
No. So it's actually in the ICC centre.
I see. Oh, wow. Okay.
It's that big.
It's that big. It's the ICC. Okay.
Yeah, it's huge. So Google takes over the ICC for the day, runs all these events, and then packs it up that night, and they're out of there.
Which I believe they've renamed back to the Sydney Convention Centre. Sydney Entertainment Centre, because no one liked the name ICC.
Yeah. Well, because when I first saw it, I was like, International Cricket Council?
Exactly,
I'm not sure. Why are we going to a cricket venue?
Yeah. No, the old Entertainment Centre is what everyone knows, and I think they've renamed it back to that. So go check that out. All right, then. Let's get on with the news items. And first news item for this week, as per usual, is People Moves. And we have a new head of Google Cloud New Zealand, Tim Dacombird, to head up New Zealand arm. And this is an article from CRN. Tim has been appointed as the head of Google Cloud New Zealand, where he will be responsible for the company's go-to-market strategy.
Yes, it says here that he's going to be working closely with partners and customers, which will be cool. And the aim is to help Kiwi businesses build an AI-first future.
Yeah, well, I think that's the aim of any C-level exec that gets put in at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
It's all about the AIs. Prior to joining Google Cloud, Tim held leadership roles at Wiz, AWS, and VMware in New Zealand. So well positioned.
Yeah, very well.
Good luck to him.
The article does mention, interestingly, Google Cloud's new Pacific Connect initiative. Gee, we're all having issues with speaking today.
It's hard, yeah.
So they're delivering two trans-Pacific subsea cables, the Hana Moana and the Tabua. And the Hana Moana cable will add a branch directly into Auckland. So the Aucklanders can have a dedicated Pacific subsea link as opposed to just leeching off us. Because normally it comes into Sydney and then it goes over the ditch into New Zealand.
Yep. And so that'll give them what they call enable a double Australian landing in Melbourne and Sydney.
Yep.
They'll have some redundancy there.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that is cool. Welcome, Tim.
Yes, welcome, Tim. And that does mean I can tag him in a LinkedIn post now. So
yes.
That's always good. Excellent. All right. Well, Moving on then, we have a little bit more industry news, and this is a little bit outside, you know, it's not quite Google, and but it is techy enough. We thought we'd talk about it. Hewlett-Packard, HPE, closes acquisition of Juniper Networks to offer industry-leading comprehensive cloud-native AI-driven portfolio. It has to be an AI-driven portfolio. Hewlett-Packard's bought Juniper. It's done. It's finished.
This is an interesting acquisition, to be honest. So Juniper's very well known for their routers and firewalls and the likes. I never really thought of them as an AI native networking company.
Yeah,
because everything has to be now. We have
it's got to be. Yeah,
I think they're just adding AI in there just to try and keep up with the Joneses.
Yes. Yep.
But Juniper makes really solid networking gear.
They do.
Really solid networking gear. HP has always been, like, HP had their ProCurve switching gear. Their firewalls are a bit meh. Their switching gear was okay. But this sort of adds that next level of awesome networking and security equipment to HPE's lineup. Mm.
Yeah, well, it brings their next gen stuff in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Into HP's portfolio. The transaction doubles the size of HPE's networking business.
Yep. Yeah, it's huge. I did have a little bit of a chuckle at this. Is the acquisition was originally announced in January of 2024.
How long did it take?
Yeah, and was approved by Juniper shareholders in April of 2024, and it has only just been completed. Now we're in July of 2025, so a year and a half.
Yeah. Just waiting for regulators?
Yeah, maybe.
I think the angle they're trying to push is that Juniper's networks are AI ready, if you follow my drift, right? They make AI networks purpose-built for AI, whatever that is, right?
What, because they use TCP IP?
It's got the static network cables.
Yeah.
If anyone's building AI networks, it's NVIDIA, right?
Yeah. Of course, I've never really been in an environment where people were actively deploying both HPE and Juniper equipment. Like, I've only ever been in environments where they were replacing them with another vendor.
Right.
I've been in an environment with Juniper gear. Their Juniper OS or JunOS or whatever it was called, I can't remember now. It was a good bit of firewall gear.
Yeah, we'll see how that pans out, and I imagine all the support's moving across to HPE, and I've used HPE support in the past, and it's been all right. So I can't imagine that being a problem for anyone running Juniper kit.
Mm.
All right, then. We need to talk about power, because power is pretty important. You need to run all this stuff, especially with AI, and as it turns out, we ended up with a bunch of power stories today.
Didn't we?
We did. So let's just throw them all in the one sort of conversation.
Throw them in the pot.
Right. Throw them in the pot, yeah. First one here is MIT has the article here from Technology Review saying we've got two big pieces of energy news from Google this week. Google's gone, the company announced that it signed an agreement to purchase electricity from a fusion company from their forthcoming power plant that they haven't built yet, from a company called Commonwealth Fusion Systems. Now, I'll throw a link to a YouTube video in the show notes as well, and you can find out all about these guys. They are building they're intending to build a power plant of 200 megawatts of power that will supply power to Google, and Google is effectively an investor in this.
Hmm.
The thing is, they haven't even built a demonstration reactor yet. That's what they're building. And that should be completed in 2026. That's a demo reactor, right?
Yeah. So that's located outside of Boston. They expect that to be up and running in 2026, but the official reactor is going to be called the Arc Power Plant.
It's interesting where all of a sudden we're seeing a bunch of these more commercial players trying different designs to bring Fusion live, and you know, not in the it'll happen in 20 years time frame, like the thing, like a shorter time frame now, but like ITER is still years away, like the it's interesting, like that program has been running for so long and is so expensive, and now
suddenly we've got something that's like 18 months away and a signed contract to like deliver power.
And the thing about these little reactors is that they'll run for 20 years, right? That the uranium that they use inside of them, it lasts for about 5 years each.
No. It's fusion, not fission.
This is fusion.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. These aren't SMRs.
So fusion. Suddenly, this is the thing. Do we have a self-sustaining fusion plant anywhere in the world at the moment?
No, we do not. Humanity hasn't got the technology yet.
That's what perked my interest with this story. Unless Google just sees it as an investment in, you know, the fusion power bucket. Because someone's got to invest in it if they want the technology ultimately, right? Whether these guys deliver or not, who knows? But the fact that they've got a plan for a, you know, they're pretty confident with their 200 megawatts of power, and they deliver their test plant first and then build the main plant. So,
I can't believe I read fusion as fission.
It's all right, man. You've been away for a bit.
This is what happens when you're skimming articles at 6 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, right.
The very small amount of uranium, which is zero.
So
small, zero.
Hydrogen, helium?
Yeah.
Who knows? So, the article does actually go on. It says here that Google's emissions have increased by over 50%. Since 2019.
That's right.
And it rose 6% last year alone.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's unsustainable, right?
Well, that's right. But their power requirements for, and I'll give you a guess what technology this has caused this, has doubled since 2020.
Mm.
Right. So they're up, their electricity consumption from the data centers was up 27% from last year or from the year before. And it's doubled since 2020, reaching over 30 terawatt hours, which is an insane number.
Yeah. So, I mean, the writing's on the wall, right? The government-supported commercial power plants are not going to be able to continue to deliver the power that these data centers need at that almost exponential growth rate in power requirement, right?
Yeah.
They're going to have to start powering themselves. So that's why the investment in this fusion tokamak. I had to go and look up what technology they're using, and they're building a tokamak to do it. So let's hope it works out. I mean, there's still problems. My understanding with tokamak design at the moment is to do with the material that's used on the wall of the tokamak. If that plasma touches that wall, it cools down and that stops the reaction.
Yeah,
so they've got to, A, get the containment right, and B, have the right sort of material to allow that to happen. So they're close. They've had minutes of sustained reaction, I think in the one in Japan. You know, these guys, I assume they're all sharing the science with each other. If these guys can just build it the right way and get the magic formula right, then they can unlock it for everyone.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. In the meantime, we've got floating we've got floating DCs.
Barns. You got bit barges.
Bit barges. I love that. I thought that was hilarious. The bit barge.
Yeah, so a Japanese shipping company, Mitsui OSK Lines, or MOL, are planning on fitting out a ship as a floating data center as a demonstration, right? So I think they're going to convert an existing ship, which is a 120-meter 9,731-ton vessel is going to be converted into being a floating data center, with a view that it can be, like, they think they can convert them in about a year, which is much cheaper, much quicker than like building a data center facility. Ooh. And I suppose, you know, in Japan where like land is at a premium as well. So they're like, well, you know, we can build a ship and we can put it in the water anywhere. And then all you need to do is, you know, dock it somewhere where you can, you know, run the old Cat 5 out to it. Cat 5 and a, you know, and a 10 amp plug.
Yeah. And the old GPO, just plug it into the shore power, mate.
So, yeah, so you can move your data center into, you know, wherever it needs to be. You can plug it in. And then they've partnered with another company, which is Kinematics, a division of Car Powership, who they build, well, power ships, right? They build these large, you know, ships that that have generators and everything on board and are designed to, you know, you can slot them into a disaster area, or if you are building a DC in an area where, you know, maybe the grid can't yet support the supply, you know, we're just touching on, we need power to run this new facility. If that's not going to be there for a while, well, you can wait for your power ship to scoot alongside and then plug in. You do all your cooling and everything. You're using the seawater or river water or whatever you happen to be floating on, and off you go, off to the races.
This article says that in places such as the US, power companies have been unable to keep up with the demand, resulting in wait times of 5 years or more before some facilities can be connected to the grid. That's insane.
That's not going to work, right? No. Like at the rate this AI hubbub is happening, that ain't workable. Five years.
Five years is too long.
I think it was last fortnight we were talking about the energy operator in South Australia is now that their grid is almost fully renewable. They've been getting a lot of additional like demand and like inquiries from like heavy industry and data centers and everything wanting to come in and go, oh great, we want to use this. But now their total requests for connection capacity, if all of them were executed, is five times more than the entire size of the current grid. It's like, we're growing, but we're not going to, you know, quintuple in size.
Yeah, in that shorter time frame. That's right. Yeah, because all the hyperscalers and the DC owners all want to go green, right? They want to have, want to say they've got green energy supply. Mm. Yeah, and speaking of the quantity of power, we do have another article as well. Google data center energy consumption has doubled in 4 years. So this is the problem, right? So since 20, and just there's a graph in this article, since 2020, we're talking just over, it's about 15 million megawatt hours. And 2024, we're over 30 million megawatt hours.
Yep. That's an awful lot of terawatts of power.
Yep.
Now, it says here in the article, the company's electricity woes are almost entirely a data center problem, which we knew because, you know, that's pretty much all Google runs.
Yeah, and some office space.
The office space, I'm going to guess, is like less than a percent of their actual electricity usage. Yep.
Well, got to put those LED lights in, you know.
no difference compared to this.
Yeah.
And this article does talk about that as well, right? Google has pledged to use only carbon-free sources of electricity to power its operations, a task made more challenging by its breakneck pace of data center growth. So there we have it. It's outstripping our ability to create renewable energy.
So just a bit further down in the article, it touches on Google's power usage effectiveness. Now, this is a measure of how well you're using the electricity that you've got. So a PU of one or PUE of one is you are using your energy 100% efficiently. right? There's not a server in the world that does that, but they come close these days. Google has their PUE has dropped to 1.09.
So if you're over one, then you're inefficient. If you're under one, then you're
well. You couldn't be under one. Efficient. One is zero, basically.
It's gone from 1.1, which is pretty good, right? Dropped 0.01 down to 1.09, right? So they're approaching the 1.0 as it comes down.
Yeah.
Right. That's going to be diminishing returns the closer you get to that, right? It's going to be harder and harder and harder to get to a power efficiency of one. Of course, it's going to be hard to get to one because, I mean, thermodynamics, right? I mean, you've got electricity coming in, you're going to have heat and sound and all the rest of it coming out of those servers. There's always going to be a loss in the system.
Yeah.
Right. So to get to one is going to be nigh impossible unless you can draw that heat away, unless you could do some calculus where you draw that heat away and you use that heat elsewhere to do something else, and then you can factor it away and say, oh, well, we are using that heat somewhere else.
Mm. Maybe they should make a server that actually uses the heat to generate the power that they're using or to assist in generating the power.
Something like that. Or, yeah, they have some reverse cycle thing that takes the heat away, and then they use that to heat their offices or in their air conditioning or something. Yeah. And then they can approach that one. Yeah, so this is a problem. I think we're going to keep seeing stories about this come up, but I'm really keen to track that fusion story, and it sounds like we're going to be hearing information on it pretty soon. All right, well, that's enough power talk for the moment. Why don't we get on to our other favourite subject? And that's VMware.
Oh, I love talking about VMware.
Boy, okay, we've ended up with a couple of VMware stories this week as well. Let's kick things off. What have we got? Article on the Register, VMware rivals ramp up the efforts to create alternative stacks. So everyone's getting off VMware and scrambling and looking for alternative things. What's on the menu for these guys?
Yeah, look, Open Nebula is a big Nebula, one that's been around for a little while. So it's a KVM-based open source stack that has reached version 7. So it says here it's a major architectural leap thanks to a redefined cloud edge orchestration engine, which is designed to support distributed sovereign and intelligent infrastructure across hybrid and multi-provider environments. It also adds ARM-based processors.
Right.
Which is cool.
Oh, yeah, that is cool. Yeah.
Yep.
And enhanced PCI pass-through.
Yeah. For your
GPUs.
Yeah, for NVIDIA GPUs. Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. Red Hat has been smashing the development on OpenShift of late. It is a really good up-and-coming hypervisor. But it's got tech previews running on Azure, Oracle, and Google Cloud now, which means that there might be some contenders to the old GCVE.
Right, yeah.
So it's also improved the way it does VM migration. So storage arrays do the job. So the old storage vMotion that we know in VMware, Red Hat's now got that as well. And Nutanix has also done a late June release with version 7.3, which added multi-cluster virtual switches and a few other bits and pieces, including storage snapshots into Azure Blob Storage.
Yeah, nice. And it looks like HPE's virtualization stack, which has kind of only really come out in the last, well, I think less than 12 months ago was their kind of recent re-release one. Sounds like that's coming across. That's their VM Essentials platform.
Morpheus VM Essentials. I love that name.
So I think I saw that that's going to be working with Veeam. So again, like so many people love Veeam. Getting the tick from them is a big deal. And I think Veeam's also going to be supporting XCPNG soon as well.
Yeah, so Zen Server Cloud Platform's next gen, which which interestingly leads us nicely into our next article.
It does, yes.
Yeah.
It's back, baby.
It's back. It is indeed, because Citrix is returning to mainstream hypervisor market, even though its product isn't quite ready for the job.
Well, this is a thing, right? I mean, you've got to be ready. This is the time, right? Strike while the iron's hot, because everyone's getting off VMware, right? Got to get a piece of it.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I use Zen Server years ago to manage VMs across an entire country, and Zen Server is good. The biggest critique I've got of Zen Server is that it only has a Windows-based management UI. It's a fat client, much like the old VMware fat client.
Oh, yeah. Man, that takes me back. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic, but it only works on Windows. There isn't there's not a Mac version. There's not a Linux version. It's a Windows client only.
They'll have to fix that. Come on.
Yes. Well, there is a company that makes a product called Zen Orchestra. And Zen Orchestra is it's a VM that you run in Zen Server, and it gives you a web-based view of your entire cluster. So for me, I had servers all across the country, and I could see all of them in Zen Orchestra, and I could actually vMotion between those servers that weren't in a cluster.
Nice.
Really cool bit of kit, but it costs money, as all things do.
Oh, they should package it up into one license.
Oh, that's right.
Charge for it all together.
Yeah, exactly.
A bundle. Zen Server Foundations.
Something like that. Yeah, Cloud Foundations.
Zen Cloud Foundations. There you go.
Great.
And they can charge 5 million euros for it.
That's it. Augustine pitched Zen Server 8.4, which was released in March 2024.
I guess they're pitching it now. It's like, hey, Zen Server, it's not just for your Citrix workloads. We can do other things too.
Yeah, so originally Zen Server was built for Citrix. Like, it was customized by Citrix for their Citrix desktop workloads only. But then it became more of a generic hypervisor. It didn't have super great support for all the different OSs out there, and it didn't have super great support for being able to vMotion from machine to machine or anything like that, but it was a good, solid Citrix desktop hypervisor. But it looks like they're really starting to try and push it out as an alternative for another hypervisor that might be causing people some pain. Like a German telephone company called Telefonica.
I'm loving these segues. Loving them.
Nice. Yes, Telefonica Germany offloads VMware support to Spinnaker due to high renewal costs. What a surprise.
Yeah. Look, they use vSphere 7 and 8, right? And that's all they're using. It's just vSphere 7 and 8. They're not using any of the cloud stuff that comes with it.
No ARIA, no NSX.
None of that. It's all, they are, by definition, an old school VMware house. So,
with 8,752 VMs across 660 hosts.
Yeah.
So not insignificant.
No, possibly one of the biggest VMware estates that we know of. They're big. So they spent over 3 years somewhere between 5 and 8 million euros over 3 years, right? When they had their vSphere 7 and 8 licensing through VMware, so their support licensing. And VMware or Broadcom has come back to them and said, you're a valued customer. And then they offered them a price that was 5 times higher than they expected.
Yeah.
Right? So you now know that over the last 3 years, they've spent somewhere between 5 and 8 million euros, and that this price for moving to VCF is 5 times higher than what they spent in 1 year.
Yeah, 25 to 40.
Yeah.
No VMware for you.
So Telefonica has gone, No, we're out. which was an interesting flip that they just went, nope, No, we're not doing
that. They were already in Spinnaker, though, so they'd used it for a couple of years to surprise support for Oracle software that they operate.
Yes.
So it wasn't, you know, a big... They didn't have to upskill or make any sort of business decisions around it. They were already sort of in Spinnaker. And, you know, why run two virtualization platforms when you can run one and run one a lot cheaper than the other? I mean, that's a bit of a no-brainer decision, really.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. And that as a little side article to this is the North Carolina State University has also quit VMware and they've gone to Red Hat's virtualization platform. So we can see lots of really big estates that are on VMware that have just chopped the cord and gone, nope, we're not paying your craziness, we're out.
I love the quote in this Telefonica article. We never thought to go away from VMware until Broadcom came up with this new solution. And we are not angry with Broadcom, but it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable what they're doing at the moment. And they tell you that you are one of the valuable customers and then they do this.
Yeah, look, I'm not angry with you. I'm just disappointed.
I love Europeans. I love the way they get it.
Yeah, it's so polite. It's the backhanded compliment.
Yeah. It's like, well, we just won't accept this. So, no.
Yeah. Yeah. And so,
we're going elsewhere.
Now, I did read in another article somewhere that, actually, no, it wasn't. I think it was down further in this article. Yeah, it is. So, Telefonica isn't the only company that's doing this. Dutch government agency, I'm not even going to try and pronounce it, RWS. Has recently won a case where the court has ruled that VMware must continue to provide it with support while it manages the migration to an alternative platform.
Right.
So I would suspect that Germany will do much the same thing to Broadcom and say, you will support it and we're getting off that.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Good times. But if you are planning on getting out of your on-prem environment you've been considering GCVE, which you certainly should, you've now got a lovely little low-cost way of getting started.
Mm.
So in the most recent, about 2 weeks ago, the release notes for VMware Engine, they have now changed the single node, like proof of concept cluster that you could deploy. They used to be, they would only be up for 60 days and then they'll be automatically deleted. You couldn't extend them, you couldn't grow them. If you wanted a single node cluster, you had no SLA.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what you got. Now they've changed it to a permanent solution. So you can spin up a single node. It won't get patched. The only way to get it patched is to delete it and recreate it. Or grow it to three nodes.
Yeah.
But this makes it a really, really nice way to kind of do a pilot deployment for your environment because having a single node stood up, you can get all of your CI/CD set up. You can get into NSX and set all your NSX constructs. You can get all your networking in there. You can do a HCX test migration. You can kind of get all the bones of your migration ready to go with one node.
Yep.
And that will be significantly lower cost as a result.
Right? Because the alternative is three nodes, right? Yep. So a third of the cost for you doing that. Yeah. Especially if you haven't done a proof of concept or anything before, right? So all those early learnings, you can do it on a single node, and then switch it up into being a full three node environment.
Because you don't want to do all that effort and have wasted effort, right? You want to configure all that out, you know, and get it all ready and bed it in, and then then switch it up to three node and off we go. Yep. Yeah,
I did notice in here that in early June. We also got the VE2 nodes in Melbourne.
Yes.
Now, I can't remember whether we covered that or not, but I'm calling it out here because that's a really cool thing to see.
Yeah. So, we've got VE2 nodes. We don't have stretch clusters in Melbourne yet, but we do have for a single zone. They are indeed available.
One that I just saw here, I had a quick read of this, that, and the V2 nodes in Melbourne caught my eye, and I did sort of didn't get past much more of it. But one of the things that I just saw here is when you're upgrading to Windows Server 2022 or newer on your GCV private clouds, so once upon a time you used to have to bring your own Windows licensing into GCVE. You don't have to anymore. You can now use Google-provided Windows Server 2022 licenses.
Yeah, there's a whole thing that you do. You have to sort of choose which licensing model you want to go down. But yeah, there's an option for you now to start getting your Windows licensing via Google, have to manage it as a separate thing.
Yep,
that's really cool.
Yep, or you can bring your own. You can do a mix of them, combination.
Yeah. But yeah.
And of course, all running on vSphere version 8, which we've discussed in the past as well. Yeah. It's very nice. Yeah.
We do like that.
So there's your VMware wrap for the fortnight. no doubt there'll be more VMware horror stories next fortnight. But just before we get on to AI wars, we wanted to have a security item here. We never really got to talk about the Qantas hack. And it falls squarely within Securitate. I found an article here that goes through some of the numbers because, let's face it, it has made mainstream news.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just like, the way they treat it, it's like, it's another hack, right? I don't think, like, you think back to the Optus leak and the Medicare thing or the HCF thing. They were big time. They were every second day or every day there was something on the news. But this Qantas one, it's like, everyone's kind of, we heard it once and it's kind of disappeared. At least in the mainstream news outlets that I've been looking at.
And it's not a small hack either.
No, that's right. So that's why I found an article that had some numbers in it, right? Mm. So we're talking about 1.2 million customer records contained name and email, 2.8 million customer records contained name, email, and Qantas frequent flyer address. The majority of those 2.8 million people also had the Qantas status tier leaked, while the airline says it's a subset of these points and balances had credits. In addition to that, a further 1.7 million people had some or all of their following data leaked: business and a residential address, date of birth, phone number, gender, and meal preference.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a small number. 1.7 million people that have, they're saying 1.3 million business and or residential addresses have been leaked, 1.1 million date of births, 900,000 phone numbers, 400,000 genders, and 10,000 meal preferences.
That's right.
You can start correlating all of that into the, 1.7 of the 4 million.
Let's just say that every person, at least in Australia, now has their correlating information available on the dark web.
Yep.
I mean, that's where we're at, right? Now, what can you do in light of this Qantas hack? Well, you can go on. They use a PIN login system. So I did this last night after reading this article. Go in and change that PIN, enable two-factor, and that's about it. That's about all you can do. I mean, your information's out there. I got the email telling me what information mine has been leaked. I don't have any points or any significant tier status in Qantas, so I'm not that concerned about it. And anyway, my information's been leaked in previous hacks anyway.
Yeah,
so.
I think all of us have these days. But
We know that you really like the kosher meal.
Yeah. I really like a steak and a beer. and that's why the importance of sites like the Have I Been Pwned site is so good.
Mm.
They do notify you when this sort of data comes on the dark web. So I use that. I've got my email and my details in there. So every time my data pops up on the dark web, I get an email from that site saying, oh, your credentials are in this leak. I'm like, oh, great. We're only in about 30-odd so far.
Just be on the lookout. Look out for scams. Make sure you're not clicking on any links in emails. Just watch your phone calls. And, you know, just accept the fact that your data's out on the dark web and that's it. Move on with life. All right. Well, let's do it. Let's get on with our favorite part of the show, the AI Wars.
AI Wars.
Yay. Dave, with all the enthusiasm of a dead rat.
First story for AI Wars. We knew it was going to happen. Google Gemini for Workspace vulnerable to prompt injection attacks. I think we predicted this, right?
Yeah, but this is a great one to go first because it is also a security issue. Because it's super simple to do. The actual attack is it's a phishing attack that triggers a fake security warning when a user opens an email and uses Gemini to summarize it. So the attack uses white on white text.
Yeah, I thought that was clever. Yep. So you can't actually see it do anything.
But and this is teachers do this in exams in schools these days. They will put white text into a document that kids then just copy and paste into a Gemini or a ChatGPT or a whatever AI tool they're using. And it'll start writing their essay for them, but it'll start including this random word that has nothing to do with it. And they'll put like, they'll have an essay on, you know, power generation or something like that. And they'll put in like, there'll be white text at the end of it and saying something along, oh, tell me all about African elephants.
Completely off topic.
And so when the teachers get this assignment handed in,
because the kids don't read it,
they hand in this assignment, and all of a sudden it starts talking about African elephants. They're like, "You didn't write this. The AI wrote this."
Love it.
That was a cool little trick that a friend of mine told me about. But yeah, so it uses prompt injection, which is not visible in the message to the user because it's white on white.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, by wrapping the instruction in a tag, an attacker can exploit Gemini's system prompt hierarchy. The AI will treat the instructions with the tag as a higher priority directive. So the vulnerability demonstration, the researcher had crafted a plausible-looking security warning with a phone number to call. Gemini would display the security alert when the user clicked on summarize the email. So whilst it's not a, hey, we've got into your account and we're pulling all the information out, it wouldn't be hard to see how this could be used to do exactly that.
Yeah, geez, it's really interesting, actually.
Yeah.
And quite simple.
Really, really simple. How cool is it? I mean, it's scary cool.
Let's get
scary. But it's still cool. This is how easy it is to get to exploit Gemini's prompts.
Mm. And then, I mean, if you extrapolate that across what we saw with that Copilot one from probably two podcasts back, I think.
Yeah, it's been a month ago, Ian.
And, you know, it's basically just the very fact that, like, the Copilot AI has kind of root access across your entire account. So if you can prompt it from one side, you can sort of access other things inside the accounts. Now, again, that was a Copilot one, but, you know, if you can kind of side inject into Gemini, and Gemini has access over your entire, you know, workspace.
Yep. It is really cool. So it's so Mozilla Foundation's Odin Gen AI bug bounty platform. It's a researcher there that did it. So well done to them. That is a super simple way of exploiting Gemini, and it looks to be very effective.
Yeah. They went looking for it and they found it.
Yep.
Yeah. And speaking of Gemini, I guess Vertex AI. Vertex AI has got a new feature, and the reason I've segued from Gemini is because you'll see in a minute, the two are related. Vertex AI has got a new feature called Memory Bank. And specifically what Memory Bank does, it stops this, helps prevent this concept called context rot. And I've been using Gemini quite heavily this week in a chat window to keep the context what I've been doing. What I've been doing specifically is one of our clients have been upgrading our client from fast version 24, version 21, to fast version 40.2. It's not the most recent version, but it is the version that they can run given their, you know, versions of the Terraform provider that they're using. And what I noticed is when I started the chat window, and I've called the, I titled the chat, I explicitly told Gemini, I'm doing an upgrade for Fast from version 21 to version 40.2. Here's a piece of Terraform. What changes do I need to make in that piece of Terraform to do the upgrade? Now, at the start, it got things completely wrong. It gave me the wrong input variables. It didn't know the format of the input variables. I had to go to the documentation and say, and then do another prompt saying, the input variable you've given me is not available on this version. Here is a list of input variables. And it literally came back and said, oh, sorry, I was looking at another version of Fast. So, okay, awesome. All right, good, you've got that context now. And so I was able to gradually improve its ability in that context window as I gave it bit snippets of code and copies of the documentation, and it was able to put that all into context and understand what I was trying to do. Now, as I've worked through, there's a lot of files to work through, right? And one of the main changes in this version was the way it connected IAM together. So it added roles to principles instead of principles to roles. So it flipped it around completely. Mm. So that meant that there was a lot of pattern changes in the way these IAM structures were set up in Terraform. And of course, they had heaps of them, so I didn't want to go through and do all of them. So I'd paste them in there and it would do it for me, right? Now, on top of that, I was using the Terraform output plan to identify where these changes needed to be made. And I noticed the more that I pasted in, it slowly started getting things more and more incorrect. It was just insisting on certain things being a certain way. And it would say, you're missing the BigQuery data viewer role. I'm like, no, I'm not. It's not even in the Terraform output. Like, why are you insisting that it's missing? And so what I then realized is what I need to do is when I put a new piece of information in, specifically in this case, the Terraform output, I would have to say, this is the latest Terraform output. Ignore all previous Terraform outputs.
Right.
Because what was happening is this concept of context rot. It was using previous inputs to make its assumption on the current output. But I had provided a new input since then, right? And the context was slowly degrading because of, in the discussion, there was dead ends, there was misinformation previously, there was old information in there from outputs that have failed before, but I wanted to ignore all of those and just use the current information. Now, unless you explicitly tell it to do that, you'll fall foul of this concept of context rot.
I think I actually had that last night. So yeah. I'm sitting there last night. So just as a another example of this, I was sitting there last night trying to come up with a logo for my new company, and and I was like giving Gemini the overview of what I wanted out of this thing, and it came up with an image, and I'm like, okay, that's pretty cool, but you know, I don't like the dark colors that you're using. Use colors more like the Google Cloud colors.
Mm.
And so it gave me one that looked just completely wacky. It wasn't even close to the Google Cloud colors. But anyway, and I said, no, I don't like that. Let's stick with the first one. Can you generate a high resolution PNG of the first image you generated? And it kept giving me the second one.
Yep.
Over yep. and over and over again. Yep. I'm like,
that's context rot. Yeah, I've had that problem with an image generation as well. Yeah. Now, there's an article on Hacker News like 28 days ago and from Rando on Hacker News. And he goes on the first part, they poison their own context. Maybe you can call it context rot, where a context grows, and especially if it grows with lots of distractions and dead ends, the output quality falls off rapidly. Even with good context, the rot will start to become apparent around 100,000 tokens. So that's exactly my experience, right? Yep. At first, it didn't have context. You start giving it a few bits of information and it latches on the context and it really understands it. But then if you keep driving in that into that context more and dead ends and distractions and more overlaying input, it just starts to get confused and it starts giving you hallucinating answers. And there were more than one occasion where I'd say, I think you're hallucinating. That's not actually, you know, a viable input or a viable... And it would come back and say, oh, sorry, I was thinking of something else. Mm. Well, no, I want you to think of what you need to think of.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very good at apologising.
He's very good at apologising, yeah. So, and then this post, good. I'll put a link to it, but they go on and say, I think you just coined context rot. What an excellent term. Yeah. And everyone's like, oh, history in the making. I'm the first person here. So, yeah. So, what this memory... engine memory bank does for Vertex AI is give it a memory bank in with the purpose, like a memory, like a brain would have a memory, right? And trying to have a purposeful place to hold the context to give it more purpose and try and eliminate this problem of context rot. So memory bank using Gemini can consolidate it with existing memories, resolving contradictions and keeping the memories up to date. So an example would be, you know, Gemini knows that you like to have the aisle seat on a plane. And so that goes into its memory bank. And then next time you do a search for a ticket or something, or you do something related to that, it will give you a result related to the memory. You don't need to like reinvent the context again.
Yeah, right. And they've got an example here on using it, a retailer in the beauty industry.
Yeah.
About creating memories about oily skin or dry flaky skin or that sort of stuff. So when you ask for a good cleanser, it comes back and says, since you have oily skin, I recommend a gel-based or foaming cleanser, blah, blah, blah.
So it,
I have
it has
no idea if that's accurate.
But it has that specific memory, right? Yeah. To say, I know that you have, which is slightly scary in a way because now we've got the AI remembering individual factoids about.
Yeah.
Well, it's not I kind of prefer that though, right? Like, it, especially for Gemini, because it's already plugged into all my Gmail and everything anyway. Mm. You might as well grab a few key facts.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yep.
Yeah, that's interesting. So context rot, I had never heard of the term before, but context rot is exactly what it is.
Yeah, that's exactly what, yep. And you need to be aware of this. But I did find a way, I probably should go on and comment on that Hacker News thread, because my way out of this was to intentionally refresh that context with the model and say, hey, this is the latest information. Ignore all previous information from this point. This is the one you've got to run with. Yep. So it kind of erases the old context. And that seemed to work, right?
Yeah, it wasn't working for me last night because no matter how many times I told Gemini that no, I don't want that image. I only want the first image you generated. It kept coming back with that same image.
Yeah.
Like,
ugh. Yeah. Yeah, and that's when you just dump the window and you dump that prompt and then go to a new one.
And then you start again with exactly the same base image that I was basing the logo off and exactly the same prompt, and it generates an entirely different image. I'm like, no.
Well, you wanted a different image, didn't you?
Yeah.
So, yeah, just be aware of that when you're using these models, and there's a fix coming in terms of memory banks. Hmm. Yeah. All right, so... just to finish off today, we came across this blog, 601 Real World Gen AI Use Cases from the World's Leading Organizations. 601.
Yeah.
Extensive list, right? We're not going to go through all of them. We'd be here for a while. It's a list.
Yeah. We do like lists, but...
We do like lists, but we thought we'd pick a couple each.
Yeah.
Let's go. Ian, what'd you pick off here?
All right. Code agents. So there's a heap of categories in this list, right? So you've got like customer agents and employee agents and code agents and data agents and all these different media creative agents, all that sort of stuff, Fantastic. So out of this, like I picked a heap of them, but the highlights for me, code agents, so there's a company called Regnology. They're a provider of regulatory reporting services. They built a ticket-to-code writer tool with Gemini 1.5 Pro, which automates the conversion of bug tickets into actionable code, which helps them streamline their development process. So it finds the bug in the code, it creates the patch for it, it submits it. How cool is that?
Submits a PR, yep. And it just needs to be approved.
someone needs to look at it and go, yep, that looks like it's going to work.
Ooh, approved. Looks good to me, yep. Send it.
Yeah. So that was my first one. That I think that is a really, really cool use for AI.
Yeah.
And the second one I've got is a data agent, and it's one here in Australia. So Macquarie is an Australian, very large financial institution. It's been using predictive AI to clean and unify 100% of its data so teams can then draw insights using Gen AI tools in Vertex AI, removing roadblocks and reducing the noise to drive better results for employees and customers. There you go. Mm. So there is AI has this fantastic ability to see multiple data sets and sort of merge them together in a way that we can use them, as opposed to you've got to think of how big Macquarie would be and having, like, they've got some SQL farm over here that's got this data in it, and then they've got a different SQL farm over here that's got a different set of data that relates to this one, but you're not really sure where it relates. AI is good at seeing those links and putting them together.
Yeah, that would take a team, you know, months to go through each line and connect it all together. There's just no way.
Yeah. So that were my two. There's a heap more in there. Like these were the top two that jumped out at me. There are so many examples in this article. It's not funny. You could literally be here for a day reading this article and all the different use cases.
Mm. Well, did you have any, Dave, that you liked that grabbed your attention?
There's just a couple of little cute ones, right? So you get all the big ones, like, you know, Unilever does this, or Bosch does that, or there's a couple of little ones, right? Like the Village Store, it simplifies accounting for its 2-person team with Gemini and Sheets, so they can get back to the hands-on work of running an old town general store. And for me, that's what it's about.
That's
it's cool. Like, we can arbitrarily be like, yeah, we can do some, you know, some amazing things in AI, but also just useful tools that small businesses can use. I use Sheets all the time. I'm loving using Gemini in my own business for all sorts of things.
It's a function in a cell now. Because
it's a function, you can squeeze it into a cell. And for me, it's very real world, tangible use case stuff.
Well, I've picked two here, and I started with Randstad because a mate of mine works at them, a large HR service and talent provider, using Gemini for workspace across its organization to transform its work culture. But the other reason I did like to pick this is because that's leading to a more culturally diverse and inclusive workspace that's seen a double-digit reduction in sick days.
That's interesting.
That is interesting. This is a good AI story.
Yeah.
I can only imagine that, reduced workload, reduced pressure, reduced stress. It's a bit more engaging using AI. I've really enjoyed the piece of work that I'm doing at the moment. I've really enjoyed doing it because I've been engaging with the AI to help me do it. It could help with that, you know. It's like you've got a colleague sitting next to you that's always pleasant and always personable and always wants to help you, right? It's like, oh, I enjoy working with this person, right?
But it's got a memory issue.
Yeah, we got ways around that. That's fine. So that could be the kind of effect that it's having, right? Oh, I'm going to go to work because I've got this person I really like working with, but it's actually the AI, right? So I found that interesting. And then the second one is Canva, of course. That's one of our clients that I've been working with. And we have, and my wife uses them regularly as well. And they're a great Australian company as well. They've been using Vertex AI to power its magic design for video, helping users skip tedious editing steps. I can tell you I've done, I edit this show every fortnight, and editing video can be tedious as well. I actually enjoy doing the edits. That's why I like doing the show. But yeah, help them skip tedious editing steps while creating shareable and engaging videos in a matter of seconds.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen the new VO3? And how cool that is.
Oh, it was phenomenal. It's just been switched on in my Gemini.
Oh, has it?
I just got the notification yesterday.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. One of the things that can be tedious if you're doing a big video edit, like in a movie or something like that, is just labeling all the clips, right? And it's usually like a junior editor or someone that'll do it. If you've got thousands and thousands of clips, it's perfect AI use case, right? It can scan the video, put a label, put some metadata on there, goes into the media bin, and it's ready for use by the editor.
Yeah, could you imagine doing that for an entire movie?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Painful. Like
thousands of scenes.
Yep, yep. Perfect AI use case, scan over it and create it.
Yeah.
So there you go. There's my two.
That's cool. I love that list. There's so many really cool use cases in there that I'll have to have a bit more of a look at.
Absolutely. Link in the show notes. Go check it out.
Mm.
Well, that's about it for us for this fortnight. Don't forget you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify and YouTube Music. Go to Apple Podcasts, write us a review to really help the show out. And while you're on YouTube, why don't you smash that like button and start this conversation there as well. You can contact the show, contact@gcpbytes.com.au. Find us on the web, www.gcpbytes.com.au. And don't forget, today's sponsor is Hive Tech Solutions, that have got new printers, apparently, and Mantle Group. that's about it from us. You guys, anything else to add?
Nah, I'm done.
No. Dave needs to go to bed by the sound of him.
Yeah,
Dave needs a coffee desperately.
Yeah,
I think I got to top up as well. All right, boys, I'll catch you next fortnight. Bye.
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 Well, I'm having a great morning.
Oh, yeah.
Good.
I'm pretty sure I'm sick, coming down with the flu right now.
I gave it to you on our meeting the other day.
Yeah, I know. Bastard. And then
I was sick yesterday.
I go to have a shower and there's no hot water. The hot water system's broken down again.
Ew, that's a bit rude.
I reckon. So last time this happened, we've got two hot water systems here. We've got one for the main house and one for the granny flat, which is sort of through that door. Well, it's just part of the house anyway. The main house broke down, and then like less than 24 hours later, the other one broke down.
Yeah.
Like within 24 hours, the two hot water systems failed. What are the chances of that happening?
Yeah, that's that put in at the same time, maybe?
Anyway, ended up being the thermostat for both of them. So I got them fixed, and now it's like 6 months later, the house has failed again. So
heat pump, baby.
Yeah, I think so. It's probably the element is got a short in it. That's usually what happens if the thermostat keeps failing. So I put the call out. They can come and fix it, and then I'll fuck it off and get a heat pump system, I think.